Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Welcome to the Sogcast number 52. My name is John Strykemeyer. I'll be your host today for this production, and we thank, as always, Jocko Willink Productions for making this happen. Without Jocko, we wouldn't have these programs, and including this special session of Sogcast, because today we are in Las Vegas with the Special Operations Association reunion, the 48th reunion, and we're joined today as our guest, I know him as R.T. Rivera, and he's a member of the SOA, but more importantly, during the Vietnam War, he was a crew chief with the 20th Special Operations Squadron with the Air Force, also known as the Green Hornets. And RT, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we think about the Vietnam War, we hear about the Army helicopters and, and that side of it. But during our secret war, I guess for the better part of 8 years, the Air Force was there with your state-of-the-art UE helicopters. And, of course, when we get into some of your story, I'll be counterpointing a little bit with my personal experience there, how I'm alive today, thanks to the Green Hornets.
Well, that's
but
great.
For your personal side of the story, I believe you joined the Air Force in April 1969?
Actually, I got into the Air Force
in
1966.
Okay, what brought you in, sir? From where?
Well, you know, I was born in Cuba.
Okay.
And, you know, I left Cuba with my mother and my 15-year-old sister when I was 16 in 1964.
Oh, wow.
Went to Spain. Of course, we're penniless now because we know we're exiles. Fortunately, we had friends and family that
and just
helped us.
Some of the younger people who are not familiar with that history in our time, the reason why you left Cuba was because of those communist bastards.
Yeah, and I still hate them, and I hated them all my life.
Oh, absolutely, sure. But the impact on your family, you had to leave your homeland.
Yes, I know. I never saw my father again or some of my other members of my family. Of course, they're all passed away now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm pretty much the only one left. You know, I have like one cousin. That's about it.
So at that point in time, what happened, you and your mom decided to leave. You went to Spain first.
Right.
And then just if you don't mind, I mean, this is a little bit off track, but it's also, I think, really apropos to what's going on even today.
Right, I know. You know, we spent almost 9 months in Spain while we negotiated a visa entry into the United States. And then we went to the United States. We stayed in Florida for a little bit. And as soon as I hit 18 years, I went into the Air Force. And I got assigned to helicopters. I didn't think it was, I thought, oh, fighter pilots, fighter airplanes, that was great. But helicopters turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, it's just surreptitiously, you know.
So you join the Air Force, and then when you go through, they give you like tests to see what your talents lie in the Air Force. If you didn't know it, your Air Force decided, hey, you'd be really good at helicopters. Forget those Phantom jets.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, and so so in 66, you go in when in April 66?
No, that was in February 66, and then
right.
Spent some time. They sent us after the helicopter school, they sent
me. Remember, we haven't had many Air Force people on, so maybe like the Air Force equivalent of basic training, and then because your MOS training, did you go from basic right into your MOS?
Yes, well, right into the school for helicopter maintenance. And after that, I got sent to Cheyenne, Wyoming. where I froze my, you know what, off.
Indeed. And after being in Cuba and everything in Florida.
I spent 3 years there. It was, you couldn't get out because it was SAC. You know, we were, we used the helicopters to take the people from the missile sites to the sites, which were out in the middle of nowhere, you know. And so there was no roads or anything. So we took them out there, left them out there, and picked them up when they were ready to come back. And that was essentially the mission there, which is pretty boring.
But again, what was your Air Force training? So you eventually wound up as a crew chief.
Uh-huh.
And so you go into your MOS training. Uh-huh. How long was that? And was that also in?
No, that was in Shepherd Air Force Base.
Where's Shepherd?
It's Texas. Yeah. So that was
I think it was like
6 months or 3 months. I forget exactly how long.
Okay.
But it was very thorough, you know. But it was pretty good.
And do you train for more than one helicopter, or because of what was going on in Vietnam, you had the UE, that became your baby?
That became a baby. You know, they actually trained us from everything from H-19s, you know, the old recip things.
And they look like the flying sausage.
Yeah,
the ugly ones.
And essentially, and after that, they sent me to Wyoming, where all they had was Hueys. So, you know, it was pretty much.
Did you get any time with an H-34?
No, actually not. We didn't have those in the Air Force.
Right.
I don't think. You know, those are
whatever they had gotten rid of. They were advancing more state of the art helicopters.
Yeah, those were old tough old birds.
They were
like the King Bees. No, they were pretty tough.
Oh, absolutely, for
they
sure.
They probably took more. They were able to take more battle damage than ours. So
well, to hear us, that's why we love them. But again, you never hear us complain about the Green Hornets, though. You guys always came.
Thanks. So appreciate it.
Up in. What was the name of that base? I'm sorry, it's Shepherd? No, Shepherd was Texas.
And then Francis E. Warren Air Force Base,
okay,
which is in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Oh.
All they have is winter and frontier days. That's it, you know.
And so by that time, we were rolling into 69, the Vietnam War, been raging on for several years.
Right.
And what was next for you then?
Next was going to pretty much went to directly from there to Vietnam, you know, landed at Tan Son Nhut, went to Nha Trang. Nha Trang was where the Green Hornets were at the time, you know, headquartered. So
and it was also the base for the 5th Special Forces.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure the 20th landed there just for that reason.
Yeah. Actually, the 14th Air Force, which is where this 14th called the 14th Special Operations Wing, which operated the Spookies and the Ranch Hands and the Blackbirds and us, you know, basically we were all part of SOG, and so that we were all concentrated there.
And the Ranch Hand would be
the Orange Orange Sprayers.
Agent
As
Orange.
A matter of fact, they were right next to our hangar, and
really?
The crew chiefs would go out because they have these nozzles
on
the wings,
and
they had to, you know, flush them out every time they land, so they. Water all over, and that water would come right through our flight line. So we're going, well, of course, at the time we didn't know it was that dangerous or anything, but fortunately I haven't suffered too many problems, health problems from it, but, you know, just a few things, but nothing important. But a lot of our guys really, we've had some deaths because of that. So
we've lost, cancer's killed more of our guys than the Viet Cong.
Exactly, you know, it's not a good thing.
No. So, welcome to Nha Trang. Mm-hmm. You hang out there a little bit, and then at some point, what happens with you and with your Green Hornets?
Well,
did they have more than one base? Because I know when I was there in 68, they were down in Ho Duc Tao, if it would be six.
Yeah.
But you would have also been in Nha Trang then.
Well, because Nha Trang was our home base, where we have the big maintenance, where the engine shops and all do major repairs. And that was kind of like a headquarters. Later on, in 1970, they moved to Tuiwa, and then after that, we went to Cam Ranh Bay. But basically, our home, real home, is Bamy Thuot.
Sure.
That's where we really operated from most of the time. Although we also operated out of Pleiku, and also one time, actually a couple of times, out of Da Nang, out of your guys.
No kidding.
Well, yeah, it actually did go to CCN.
Sure.
For a short period. Very, really, very, very different environment.
Well, and again, we should, just to get a little historical context here, in the end of November, I think it would be November 26th, they had a mission with the recon team, which was a focus of Sawcast number 50 with Randy Harrison, who was on a recon team out of CCS.
Right.
And they ran into a world of shit. And the Green Hornets saved their bacon, just like they did 2 days later on Thanksgiving with our recon team. But on that mission specifically, the Air Force pilot, Lieutenant Jim Fleming, later earned the Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. And there was just so much of that going on.
Yeah.
And that's just to set the time frame for the valor involved. And I know in my personal experience, the first time I flew in the Green Hornet UE, it was different than the Army UE.
Yeah.
It was more powerful, it was faster, and they had the, how'd you mount those miniguns? Because your miniguns had more, seemed to have more flexibility.
Well, it was actually by design. The P models, which you flew, they were originally the UH-1F, which is what we had in Wyoming. What happened is that kind of a long story. The 20th SOS was called the 20th Helicopter Squadron. They were based in Thailand, and they had two types of helicopters. They had the CH-3s, which were used long range, which they used to go to Laos. Of course, the Hueys didn't have the range to go from Thailand all the way to Laos, so it was decided to move all the Hueys over to Natrang and operate differently.
And the HH-3s, excuse me for interrupting, but the HH-3s were like the forerunner to the later versions of the Jolly Green Giants.
Right. You know, they were
the
Jolly Green Giants.
Then the CH-53s,
correct.
Bravo, Delta models that the Marines had for Operation Tailwind.
Right. So the Hueys, the F models, were converted as something called the Lucky Tiger conversion. they did. They had to install the weapon systems. They had to actually put some new electronics on it, different radio gear and scramblers, all kinds of things that they had to put on there. And there was redesignated UH-1P. So that's how, but so it wasn't like a Mickey Mouse conversion. It was actually done in a factory.
A major upgrade.
A major upgrade, yeah. So it operated real well because of that, you know.
And did that include a bigger engine or a more powerful engine somehow?
No, the same engine. The T-58 was pretty powerful, and just because of the horsepower, because we had a big speed decreaser gear, which gave it a lot of torque. So there was one occasion where one of our gunships, fully loaded, picked up an entire team.
No.
Including a 7-man team. I mean, they crammed them in there and picked them up just because we couldn't get a slick in there.
Yeah.
Picked them up, hovered out, and away they went. No problem. You know, so it was pretty powerful ship.
Yeah, because the early gunships that we had with the Marine Corps and the Army, had they tried a fully loaded gunship, they never would have got.
It was funny. The gunners running on the side.
Oh yes,
running on the side.
You saw that in the early models too.
It was so funny. You used to laugh at those guys.
Oh, we did too. I mean, we were at Fubai, the same thing, because the Marine Corps Scarface. They had, I forget what their models were, like a Bravo or a Delta model of the UE, and even the muskets that came out of the 176 from the AmeriCal, and those door gunners, when they were loaded, they did sometimes because of the heat, and they had a fully loaded ship to get it off the ground. They even put some wheels on the front of the skids.
Is that right?
So those would get it like a King Bee would have wheels. They kind of go down a hard runway.
That's clever. That's clever. That's good.
Yeah, they thought about, but again, you guys never had to worry about that. That's incredible.
Yeah.
But again, here's one more little story. Just another day in SOG with the SOS and the Green Hornets.
Yeah,
amazing. So, as you evolve, as you get into the flow there, how do things go for you? What's your duties? And then, what are some other missions that kind of stick out in your mind? Because there's a lot of history with the Green Hornets there.
The moment I got there, they looked at me. I had some experience, from being 3 years working with the Hueys. So I says, okay, you're going to be a crew chief. This is your ship. And would you be interested in flying? As a gunner. I said, okay, sure, no problem. So I said, okay. So we had to run through a security check. We had to get a top secret clearance because of what we were doing.
Yeah.
And it's a funny story. There was an orientation. 14th Air Force, mandated that, if you're going to be doing classified stuff, you have to have a security briefing by some crazy person. Anyways, I'm sitting there, and there's like 30 or 40 people in this briefing room, all of them pilots, you know, lieutenant colonels, majors, captains, whatever. I was the only enlisted guy in there.
So just sergeant?
I'm sitting there, you know, listening to this thing. And the guy asks, is anybody there from the 20th SOS? So I raise my hand and says, the guy says, well, I'll talk to you after all these guys leave because your mission is so classified, they can't hear it. Oh. Yeah, these guys were looking around like, what
really?
The hell is this? It was funnier than hell.
No kidding.
I had to laugh. You know, it was really funny. After that,
did you have to sign an NDA too?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. So tell us about the briefing then, after everybody left.
Everybody left. No, the guy just says, hey, look, you're going to go into Cambodia. You know, this mission is classified. You will not talk about it. You can't tell your family. You can't tell nobody. You know the usual thing.
Yeah, yeah.
After that, you know, I get back to my squad. Says, okay, you're going to go now to the Philippines for jungle survival school. So
really?
They sent us to jungle survival school. That was kind of fun, you know. You know, it's nothing like what you guys went through, you know, but it was very instructive. You know, we had the Negrito natives show, you know, take us out in the jungle and,
yeah,
you know, give us some lessons on how to light a fire and that kind of stuff. You know, we probably would not have lasted a
how
day.
How long was that?
It wasn't very long. It's like a month or month and a half.
That's pretty long.
Yeah. Anyways. So I got back and immediately started out to fly. We're very structured. We have to have training before.
Sure.
They're not just going to put you in the helicopter and say, go fly and do this mission. You have to go through training for both slicks and for gunships. And you have to be certified by an instructor. And once you're certified, then they'll allow you to go ahead and fly in the actual missions. But of course, you're a new guy.
Sure.
And you know, people look at new guys and they go, we don't know about him. We don't know if he's going to crack or whatever.
Sure.
Anyway, so my first trip out to Bamituit, I get out there and they put me with one of the best slick, it was a slick, first on this mission was with a slick. Anyway, so we go out there and they put me with one of the most experienced guys, one of the very, very, very best slick gunners, Ron Kearsmakers. And we go out and we fly a couple of times out there. They drop a couple of teams, nothing big deal. But the first time we flew out, we came back to base. And me, of course, being an idiot trained by the Air Force, was ate up completely stupid. I have to back up a little bit.
Sure.
We had two kinds of gunners. We had helicopter mechanic gunners and weapons specialists. We were two different MOSs.
Right.
And
okay.
the reasoning for that, I guess, is that they thought that you would have to have one of each in each ship, just in case of one of the weapons malfunction or something else happened. Anyways, so I, as a helicopter mechanic, you know, we get back from the first flight. And the other guy, who is not a helicopter guy, asked me, hey, I'm going to go upstairs and check the rotor head, which is one of the maintenance things.
Sure.
And I said, no, I'll take care of it. You know, you go ahead and go to the club or whatever. The guy looked at me like, hey, you're a tired little dude. You know, I don't like you. Anyways, he said, okay. You know, I said, all right. So I did my thing. And we flew back and forth a couple of times, no action. Until our first hot mission. And our first hot mission, you know, we got into there and the team was in trouble as usual, like you guys always get in trouble. And we go down, we do our we get down all the way down. The team guys are firing over to the right. So I'm firing the 60 over there. The yards are coming in, we're hauling them in. Finally the Americans come in and we take off, you know, I'm still hosing away.
Sure.
And I remember that getting hit over the helmet. Look over there with the SF guys hollering, you beautiful guys, thank you. You know, whatever, you know, they're a bunch of crazy guys. Guys were all crazy.
Yeah, but we loved our aviators. We were crazy, yes, but we loved our aviators.
anyway, we get back all the way back to the base. And, you know, and all of a sudden, I tell him, hey, why don't you go check the rotor head? So he goes up. And after that, I was a Green Hornet. I wasn't a new guy anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so it was it was quite an experience.
You broke your cherry out there.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I mean, go just for personal curiosity. When you do some of your helicopter training, mm-hmm. I assume there's training when you're actually flying with a helicopter, shooting both with the M60 mm-hmm. and with the minigun at the time. What was that part of that training like?
Well, let's see. Well, like I said, we scheduled training flights for both the pilots and for the gunners. For the gunners, you have both typically two new gunners, one on each side, and then the instructor in the center observing what they're doing. And we also have an instructor pilot and a student pilot. And we run through dummy missions. You know, we do go to low level, we do like an LC pickup, and we also do the ladders and ropes? Yeah, oh yeah, everything.
Oh, no kidding, okay.
So this goes on for, you know, as long as it takes, you know, as long as it takes to get you certified. If the instructor feels that you're not gonna make it, they just kick you out of the thing, you know. So it's not, it takes a bit. It takes at least 10 training flights or so to get approved.
Oh, sure. Because the thing that impressed me was, if you figure a helicopter's going whatever speed, 100, just mm-hmm. for the sake of argument, 100 or 120 yeah. miles an hour, mm-hmm. and you're going, you see enemy troops, you want to hit them, uh-huh. there's got to be some kind of firing where you aim a little bit ahead because the rounds are going to bend a little.
Yeah.
And what?
You adjust for Kentucky windage.
There we go.
that's what we called it. You know, but yeah, especially when
But what was that like adjusting? So you're able to see that?
You can see the tracers, you know, where every fifth round is a tracer.
Yeah.
So you can just see where it's going pretty much. We never use any sights or anything like that. We just wing it, you know. If we watch where the bullets are going and you go for it. And, you know, and then, of course, we always get adjustments from the troops on there. It's get a little closer, you know, a little closer. Yeah. Or I can hear them screaming, you know, that kind of thing.
It's, sure.
It was fun.
Well, I remember my first major firefight, one of the surprising things, which was the shell casing from the 7.62 round landing in my collar. And at first I'm going, shit, it's burning my neck. And I'm going like, that's cool. Yeah, these guys are really close.
Actually, when they're on the slick and you're in the hole and the gunships are going directly overhead firing, all you hear is tink a tink a tink a tink a tink. All the casings and the links, everything falling right on the rotor head.
Sure.
You know, it didn't do any damage, but it was always interesting to hear it.
That's really close even to you guys.
Yeah, no,
it's
normal. It was just normal.
The
normal
SOP.
Procedure. You know, you wanted to hear that. You wanted to see that.
Sure.
Because as long as they were going overhead, you felt pretty safe.
Yeah, so so as you evolved into 69, mm-hmm. there's different missions, and then how does it go with you with the 20th? Because the 20th was there for most of the war assigned mm-hmm. to SOG, correct?
Right.
Because they were early, and at the Trang, by the time you get there, mm-hmm. they're still running and flying hard.
Yeah.
And was there any kind of, did you see any changes in the tactics from the enemy or missions, or how'd your tour do? If you get in country in April of 69,
right.
then did the Air Force do a one-year tour of duty? Was it 13 months?
It was a one-year, but you could extend for 6 months, which I did. And then, like I said, I came back they sent me back to the States, to Enid, Oklahoma, for 3 months. And 3 months is about all I could stand of peacetime Air Force. So I volunteered to go back, and they sent me back right back to the Hornets. And another year and a half.
And so when you went, so aside from how bad was Oklahoma, what were you just doing?
Well, we were flying H-43s with the rescue and fire suppression, which is when you put a big bottle it's a big giant bottle of fire suppressant that in case we had an aircraft crash, you know, mm-hmm. we would pick up the bottle and transport it right next to the burning aircraft, and the firemen would immediately start hosing it down. So it was kind of an important mission, but it doesn't quite match to
nothing like being under fire.
Yeah, nothing like you know, like on Lotto, you know, you've never lived until you almost died, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So during that first year and a half, was there like one or two missions where you know a team's in trouble and you guys go out, or any mission at all where maybe you're supporting another element. Were you guys really flying this some heavy shit?
Yeah, we had.
Because you're very modest, like most of our guys.
I didn't keep a journal, so it's been a long.
Yeah, they told you not to, and you're like me. I didn't either. I wish now that I had.
Yeah, well, some guys did. You know, I don't know what they did it at night or whatever. I don't know what they did, but they did it. But you know, we had all kinds of different things. I remember. There was one particular mission where, you know, I thought it was like 6 hours, or some guys say it was 8 hours that we were going at it. What happens is that we typically go out to, from Bamituat, we would go to Duck Lap or Duco or Bandon, these little villages that were right next to the
border.
And we would sit there. We brief, and then we go out and drop the teams off in Cambodia. And, of course, we came back and refueled or whatever and waited to see if the guys got in trouble or not. And then, of course, then we went back home to Bamituat at night. There was a few times when we had these big, long battles. Like, I remember that, like I said, a six-hour gun battle that I think some guy said it was eight hours. What happens is that we go out with two slicks, we fly in a formation of four. Four gunships, four slicks. We land at Duke or Banda, whatever it is. We take two of them, two gunships and two slicks, and go out and do an insertion. And we go back. In case of they get in trouble, again, we go out with two gunships, two slicks, and of course a FAC. And we try to pick it up. If the slick gets shot pretty hard, we can't get it. The gunships expend all their ammo. We gotta get all the way back and reload.
Sure.
And the way we reload is, you know, we go. They had these big blibbits of JP-4 out there with one little hand pump. We fill up. We never stop a helicopter, and we keep it going. We go over there, and the yards usually had the rockets ready, so we could just throw them in and reload. And they also brought us eight cans of 7.62, 1500 rounds. We load them into the ship, the whole cans, and then we take off again to go out again towards the firefight. And during that time that we're in the air, the gunners are reloading the cans, the ammo cans, because we have an electric-driven ammo that feeds the gun.
Yeah, for the minigun.
Right, and just throw the cans overboard, and then we're ready to go, and we go back in. We did this three times.
Wow.
And it was, you know, of course, it's like hour out, hour back, reload, go back out. Okay, and for us gunners, you know, it was pretty tiring. But actually, I fell for the pilots because those armored seats were the most uncomfortable seats in the world. By the time we were done, the pilots could barely walk. We had to kind of help them out. I mean, it was that bad.
No kidding.
You know, it was intense.
You never think about pilot discomfort.
We got the team out, though. It worked. It was almost dark by the time we got out of there, and it was an experience. Did that a couple of times, so it did happen.
And when you all did that with the gunships first, if you made the gun run, that would be like, how would that work out? Would it be side by side, or would one go in and the second one would come right behind it?
No, see, everything that we did is pretty much low level. The FAC would guide us. We would go out, when let's say that we have an insertion.
Yeah.
We would have one slick and two gunships to do the insertion, and another slick in the back just kind of waiting in case something else happened or they needed it. The FAC would guide us down like at least four or five clicks away from the actual LC, and we'd go on the deck. He would say, okay, go down, make a right turn, make a left, go left 160 degrees or whatever. All blind. We didn't know where the hell we're going. As far as the FAC overhead is guiding us directly into the LC. We just
really?
Nothing. So the idea was we don't want to be out high where they can see us coming down. You know, we're not like the king bees that we're doing this thing.
Spiral.
It's all low level. Get out there. You know, the slick would flare and go down into the LC. The gunships would go around in case something happened. Until we came right, and we tried to do it fast, just as fast as we could to get down. We tried to avoid hitting too many trees, but if we had to, we little branches and stuff. Anyways, and then we'd go out, and again, the FAC would guide us out another couple of clicks away. So trying not to give too much orientation to where government are going for the VC to figure out, or sure, the NBA to figure out where the team was.
Yeah, then also in 68, we had that, which they seemed to do it really regularly, which was a fake insert. Sometimes they would do fake, real,
right,
or fake, real, fake. Yeah.
Actually, after a while, we stopped doing that because I guess the density of the enemy was so bad, it was a little different in down south than up north where you guys, you know, because we're the flat terrain, so we could do more of the low level things. You know, it was a little difficult when we went up north. We had to adapt our tactics a little bit too.
Oh, because, no kidding.
Because all the mountains, I mean, tried low leveling in the mountains, you got the mountains of people shooting down at you.
Right. It's
not a good thing. So we developed a different thing. Normally, what we would try to do, if you can imagine, let's say we had a hot exfil and we had the gunships going in, you know, we would go in low again, we would look at we would try to orient ourselves to know where the enemy was so we know where to fire. You know, we'd watch the smoke and the panels and everything else that you guys had down there. We fly right over the LC, the slick would come down, we would fly right on top of it, and we make a figure eight pattern like this right over the LC. And the idea was that when it was one gunship right on top of the slick and then one gunship right on the outside of the figure eight.
Yeah.
So you would go like this and you would have coverage all the way, almost continuous coverage. And what happened is that you were flying, probably doing 80 knots or 90 knots, and the moment you went over the LC, you would bang, I guess, the ships were almost like this. You would, as a gunner, you'd be looking straight down.
Straight down.
And the course of G's, you're wearing the armor and everything else, and plus your gear and your all the other stuff. And it took a little strength. And of course, we had no seats or anything. You were just crouching.
Yeah,
but it was exciting. It was very exciting.
Just getting back to being sitting on the floor, because the first insert, the pilot, you know, said, "Hey, we're going to be napping the earth. We're going in. We're tight. We're fast. Mm-hmm. You know, and don't let your feet dangle too much because we're going to be."
You can hit the trees.
the branches. And we had done a little bit of that with the 101st. Mm-hmm. And of course, when the King Bees inserted, they did their yellow falling leaf.
Is that what they called it?
Yeah.
That's
and
funny.
That's their spiral going in. So that was really different. But that was different. Mm-hmm. The Green Hornets, that thing was like, they were right there. And I really, there's a couple times like, whoop. And they were all.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On ass, and then we flared right on the target, and they did the fake inserts. Then mm-hmm. This is because that's November '68.
Yeah,
but it sure helped because we were on the ground.
Yeah,
and then we had two more inserts. I was only there for three missions, but each time we got in, really good inserts. Those guys were slick.
Yeah, we try to be stealthy. That's the whole point of, of Recon. You know, it's we're not out there to be engaged in, you know, John Wayne crap. We're just trying to find out what the enemy was doing. You know, it's just, it was, and the guys were really good. We had some great teams down there. Of course, you know, we had, you know, Baby Son Davidson. We had some legendary guys down there, Jim Day.
Of course, Jim.
These guys were tops, you know.
Like Mad Dog, we had Rob Graham.
Oh, yeah.
the only SOG 1-0 to take a bow and arrow to the field to do battle with the NBA. Oh, my goodness, yes.
Some great times.
Yeah, so as you're going through that first tour of duty, was there any other missions, or what was your overview of that? Because if you're there, see, I'm trying to keep my calendar straight. If you're April 69, May of 69, then you would have been there for the incursion.
I left there for Oklahoma like a month before that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So I missed that, but that wasn't any big deal. I mean,
no.
Well, you know, the it's not our mission. Our mission was recon. You know,
sure.
not invading.
Well, I didn't know if the 20th got drug into that for
some
sort
of
support.
Drugged into it.
But you were out of country, so.
Defensive work, you know, but not really anything that interesting, you know.
Right.
You know, of course, I was there for so long. I flew so many hours that at some point in time I became an instructor, and then I became the head instructor who trained the instructors, that guy kind of thing. So
that's
a very structured thing, you know, it's a very, very, very structured thing.
And then also before, you had, when you said your FAC would take you in, was your FAC another helicopter?
No.
Or was it a fixed wing?
No, it was the OB-10s or the regular.
Or the O-2s?
Yeah, 21st TASS is what they were.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, you guys had the 20th TASS.
With Snoopy on the doghouse.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. They were phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, the guys are pros, you know.
Oh, absolutely, no question. Yeah. I mean, the training, and hell, when they came down tight, you could see the scratches on the bottom.
Yeah.
From where they've been too close to the treetops a few times.
They were the best. They gave us some great, great, great instructions as far as, you know, they were very thorough. They would take you guys out to do the recon to find out the LCs.
Yeah, sure.
These guys really, really earned their keep. You know, they're actually probably some of the most underestimated people around as far as...
Something that people just take for granted almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're in October, so 2 months ago, I'm outside, my lawnmower died, and I'm working on my lawnmower, and I heard it. I heard that O2.
Is that right?
There was an O2 flying over the house, and I'm going like, whoa. It just stops you, you know, you hear that sound.
Nice plane.
After so many times being down on the ground with that, and here comes the Air Force.
Yeah.
We love you, man. So as your career changes, when you became the instructor, did that happen during your second tour or near the end of your first?
First tour, probably three-quarters of the way into it.
Okay. And so when you've got the experience, do you find things that you can fine-tune what you're doing, or was things so up to scale by that point just to keep the high standards of being qualified?
Yeah, you always learn. You never stop learning. I mean, it's always something different going on, you know.
Right.
I mean, we transitioned from McGuire rigs to Stables. You know, we had all kinds of different crazy weapons that we tested. We actually had a pintle-mounted 40 millimeter.
Really?
To try that, it was ridiculous. I mean, this thing, the floor of the Huey, just wasn't strong enough. We would go boom, da, boom. It was crazy. You couldn't. We gave up on it. We just kept the
minigun. A little too much kickback, huh?
Yeah, it was just too crazy.
Oh, my goodness. But you tried.
We tried it.
Yeah.
Some guys at Herbert Field, which is the place where the Air Force Special Operations Command is, they always come up with these crazy things, you know, and that's and that's one of their inventions, I guess.
Well, yeah, but again, just from the change from seeing what the regular Army had to coming down to the Air Force standards with that, and just something as simple as the minigun that was more maneuverable, it made all the difference in the world.
It made all the difference in the world.
Absolutely, particularly in support of the close air support.
Yeah.
It just didn't get any better than that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, oh yeah, absolutely. So as you're going forward with the training, do you still occasionally go out to stay sharp?
Oh, all the time. No, I mean, you don't stop going out. Just because you always have to maintain your proficiency. So you never stop going out. You only do training when you get back to Nha Trang, you know, for a month or two. I mean, you rotate all the time. So we're not there at the FOL all the time. So
you know. And so what, as this period of time goes on for you, is there other parts of the 20th Special Operations Squadron's history? Is there other things that are evolving or parts of what the mission is? Does it expand? Or when the Vietnamization starts, does that hit the Air Force right away? Or do you be able to keep the high standards, the number of aircraft? Because I remember that mission from November 26, 68, mm-hmm. the first three or four helicopters were shot out of the sky mm-hmm. or so heavily damaged mm-hmm. that Fleming's helicopter was the last one still able to fly.
Right.
And that's what was part of his earning the medal, was he went back and was able to pull the whole team out after hovering for a long period of time under fire. And did you have many other missions like that?
Yeah, a few.
A few.
But the thing, you know, the one of the funny things about CCS, of course, is that into Cambodia, is that we didn't have, you know, we didn't have A1Es, we didn't have F4s. We were it. If we had in trouble, we had to take care of ourselves, you know, which is one of the reasons why we had to do these 6-hour gun battles, you know, that's we had to take care of ourselves, you know. But eventually, as time progressed, you know, we started to run out of helicopters. You know, we had several problems. Besides the battle damage or the ones that got shot down, we also had problems. The T-58 engine, like we talked about, is very powerful, but it had an axial compressor, which, unlike the compressor of the centrifugal compressor of the T-53, which is what the Army Hueys used, it was very susceptible to all our dust and sand and stuff that's in the highlands. So we had a lot of engine failures. And of course, the Air Force didn't have that many Hueys to begin with. You know, they just bought them for these missile sites, and all this after that is just an ad hoc thing that happened. So eventually, we started to run out of helicopters, and we had to get finally we got new helicopters. We got the N model helicopters with the twin engine Huey.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we got that like around late '71. You know, I was there for that transition.
Yeah.
But I was very disappointed.
Why
and
is that?
Let me tell you what. The ship was very powerful. It had twin turbines. It was very safe.
58s or the 53s?
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, they had no. It wasn't T-58. It's a whole new engine.
Okay.
Yeah, a whole new engine pack. Anyways, the ship flew faster. It did 120 knots easily, as far as that is concerned. And it was very powerful. It made a fairly decent slick. I mean, but it had a big cabin like the H models, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it had more room than what we had before. But as a gunship, it was a miserable failure. And the reason why is you would think it would be able to carry more ammo, more weapons. Uh-uh. The P model, we carried 12,000 rounds of 7.62. And the N model, we only carry 8,000 rounds.
Really?
And the reason why is because the cabin was shorter,
mm-hmm.
and the ammo cans couldn't be as tall and couldn't hold as much. I mean, they could have made them wider, I suppose, but some genius said, they don't need that much. Okay.
Yeah, for the people that have never been on a firefight. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't need that much ammo. What the heck? Anyways, and another problem that we had is, like I said, originally we used to fly 80 knot patterns with the figure eight, and we could hold a very tight pattern, and we can get constant coverage. These ships were so fast that they would go over, and they had to do a dog bone pattern, which was kind of a longer pattern,
mm-hmm.
which means we lost some of that time.
You had
that
gap
covered.
In time where you're not suppressing fire.
And that really made me mad. I was on the tactics review panel. And I keep telling the pilots, okay, let's try to fly a tighter pattern.
Sure.
And we tried. And we actually tried, but when we tried it, the ship just kind of shuddered because it just couldn't do that kind of maneuver, so that kind of speed. You know, we lost RPM. It just wasn't workable. So it was kind of a given, you know, that we had to do it that way. But, wow. You know, of course, we adapted. And by the time Vietnamization was going on, like you were saying, so eventually the Vietnamese teams started to go out there, and they didn't do that well.
Yeah.
I remember a case, we were flying with the Kingbees, as a matter of fact, we were supporting the Kingbees. And they were picking up a Vietnamese team that was in trouble. We came down in the gunships. We hosed them all down. King B did a spiral thing, but came all the way down, picked them up. But it had to do a rope ladder exfil. These guys got into the rope ladder, but they didn't tie themselves down. King B started going up. King B, come up. So up they went. They started falling off.
No.
Started falling off. There was one guy left, you know, and he was hooked up by, went over backwards. It was hooked up by his foot. And we're watching this going, my God, it's just like a bad movie.
Yeah.
The guy fell off again. King B came around and tried to pick that guy up. And sure enough, they were able to fish him up between the trees. We're watching all this. You just couldn't believe it. And the guy fell off again, and eventually they just gave up, and, you know, I guess assumed that the guys were dead or something, you know. But that was
that was
a terrible thing. I never saw anything like it, you know.
I can't imagine.
I
can imagine. But that's a terrifying image.
Yeah, no. But you know, these guys just didn't have the proficiency that you guys had. You know, it's just insanity.
Wow. Yeah. So.
Very strange things happen.
Absolutely. It must have been, so during your time, so we get to the second tour of duty.
Uh-huh.
Was that a major change? Is that part of the Vietnamization was beginning to kick in at that point in time, or what?
It took a little bit after. It started a little bit after, you know. After most memorable thing probably was one trip to CCN with the N models. Of course, by that time we had the big rope ladders, you know, the metal, big metal rope ladders, you know, like the Kimbys used them too, but of course you only had one side. We put them out of both sides.
Sure.
So we our first mission out there, I'm on the slick, and we go out there and we have to do a rope ladder exfil, and we pop out both rope ladders, and the guys are so used to getting into the one side that they all got on one side, so now we had seven guys hanging on to one side. And it was, so instead of going to the other side.
Oh, no.
It was all the crazy things that happened, you know. CCN was very interesting because, you know, we had missions where we had to be firing into one hill, so we had to, instead of being on the low level, we had to be like a couple of hundred feet up and do a racetrack pattern just to suppress on the side. But it was quite a different thing, quite a different terrain.
Sure.
Not a very nice terrain. And unfortunately, too, there were so many booby-trapped LCs. I don't know if that was the same thing when you guys were there, because I don't know how many times we aborted. We tried to insert teams in, and as a guy was says, yep, and so we aborted, get out of there, because it saw booby traps everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, of course, by that late in the game, it was... Yeah. Pretty bad out there.
Just like getting a feeling for some of your lessons learned, and then also as an instructor, and that's pretty cool to be an instructor, but you're still staying active. It's mm-hmm. not like you get a promotion.
Yeah, no.
And now, like some of the Army times, the people that have been on the ground, mm-hmm. now they're instructors, and then things could change rapidly, and you're out there to experience that firsthand. Did you find some of that too, where you, like you said, you were talking about your experience at CCN. Let's get into that in a little bit more detail. But mm-hmm. You asked me a question, which was, had I experienced that? And the answer was yes. Mm-hmm. One time we were doing a spiral in, mm-hmm. and I forget if it was Fook or Sal, they yelled to the door gunner and they aborted. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking down, I don't see anything. I'm going like, mm-hmm. what, buku dinky dow, you know? Mm-hmm. Teasing, of course, but yeah. I knew he had a real reason. And then through the interpreter, they said that they had seen a wire mm-hmm. across the LZ. Now, how'd they see a wire when we're going in? I don't know.
I don't
to this day. But it was attached to a 500-pound mm-hmm. bomb. They knew we were coming, uh-huh. and we were spiraling in on it.
Yeah, I know. It's just a...
So what mm-hmm. were you finding? And again, could you put that into a context? I assume in your second tour of duty, you guys had north for a little bit of time up there, mm-hmm. and... I mean, I'm biased, of course. As we tell our stories, each AO, the area of operations mm-hmm. up north, is different.
Right.
To Khantoum, which is different.
Right.
Which is both tri-border area, and then Cambodia, which is flat. But you still had some mountains and hills that could cause great consternation.
Yeah. No. But it seems like, to my mind, you know, what you guys did up there up north, it's like suicide mission, you know, because the terrain is so difficult, you know, all these tall, I don't know, people understand how scraggly and horrible these little mountains are.
Then you throw some triple canopy on it.
Exactly, and it's very easy to mount, you know, 12.7 mils up there and shoot everything out of the sky. The thing is, like, it seems like the density of NVA was much higher out there than it was down south. You know, they talk about the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It's not just coming from the north. It's also coming from the south. It's kind of like, you
through
know,
Cambodia.
Exactly. So
it was a Sihanouk Harbor. Then they had a couple of trails that came in. They never talked about that much.
No, they never do.
But you saw the experience of it.
Oh, hell yeah. But the thing is that by the time that we got up there up north, I think that the area was so compromised. There was so many more density of enemy out there that it's made it almost like a suicide mission to put these guys out there. I don't know why they even tried anymore.
No kidding. But so what was your time frame then?
Christ, it must have been late 71, early 72.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Somewhere on there, you know. That's pretty heavy concentration. But it was interesting.
Well, very.
Yeah, very interesting.
Because even in 68, when they had the bombing pause in November, mm-hmm. which they kept, then we saw more and more mm-hmm. anti-aircraft. So by the time you get there, at the end of 71, mm-hmm. into 72, there must have been buku.
Yeah, buku. Because, you know, it seems like every time that we went out there, we end up calling F-4s. Or A1s. It's the first time I've ever seen them, you know, flying around. I was watching those F-4s going, doing those bomb runs like that.
Yeah.
It's crazy stuff. And I was going, all right.
You ever see the A-1 Sky Raiders?
Yeah, yeah. Those guys can kick some behind.
They were great. But so, and then what did you all do to adjust? If there's more, how would your insertions be? What was your different, like Cambodia, you're napping the earth, but the nap could turn into a crap.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, we had a shorter insertion round, so it didn't seem like it anyways. And sometimes we would have to just do one of these gliding type of things, right? Never did this thing, you know. That's
so you'd be at one elevation, like 4,000 to 5,000 feet. Mm. We got closer to the LZ, we go directly in.
Depending on what the terrain was, we just had to adjust, you know, because you have the mountains here, mountains there. You never know what the heck was going on. So,
and then you'd also had to worry because there's ever increasing anti-aircraft activity.
Exactly.
What was the worst up there that you came into? Would it be like the 37 Mike Mikes, or was it the 57s with had the anti-aircraft, like the World War II ACAC? Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you run into that stuff?
I personally didn't. You know, some of the guys did, but I personally didn't. Worst that happened, one, it was pretty funny. Took probably an AK round, it had to be, came through the skid on my side, and of course, the skid has a pretty heavy shoe, steel shoe on the bottom. So it took it pretty much, I mean, we were probably 100 foot off the ground. Went through that, went through the cabin floor in between my legs, got on top, bounced off. By the time I was expanded, bounced off the top of the top of this roof of the helicopter, and then landed right inside of my neck. So I was going doing this little number in there. It was really funny. Yes, it was hot as hell. Of course, it was the steel.
After a lot of friction going through the metal.
Yeah, but all the jacket had gone off. It just had the steel. The steel core of the AK round, you know.
No kidding.
That's so funny.
Whoa, that's too close for comfort.
I took a shrapnel on the leg, but that's about the only thing that I ever got.
After all those gun runs?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, never got
it. So it must have been, that could be reflections on the good training and
just sheer
execution
luck.
Or?
Sheer luck.
Sheer luck.
Sheer luck.
By the grace of the good Lord, it wasn't your day, or
no, that's it.
Oh my goodness! So how long were you up there at CCN?
I was there probably 3 months.
No kidding.
Yeah, but and I think total duration of the mission was maybe 6 months or five, 6 months at most. You know, it wasn't a long one.
And is that when you were wrapping up your time of duty in country?
Close, pretty close to that time, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was in late 72 or early 73, I think, is when the squadron disbanded.
Really?
And that was the end of the 20th for a while until we reconstituted again until later.
And when
on.
Was that? Because they're still flying today, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They got Ospreys and that kind of thing, you know, at the time.
We don't want to talk about Ospreys.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have worked in Vietnam at all.
No.
But for a while, they flew the Pueblos. As a matter of fact, people don't know this, but when the Desert Storm started, you know, the first Iraq War,
sure,
they were flying CH-53s, which at the time were the only helicopter that had Doppler radar navigation. You know, they called it what was it called? Pueblos, and the Pueblos. They used, you know, the army choppers didn't have that, of course. So the very first attack by the U.S. and there was led by Pueblos, led a bunch of Apaches across the border to hose down some of the areas around there. And after that, so that was the beginning of the war on the ground. And then, of course, later on they inserted a bunch of SF guys into different areas to make fuel depots and that kind of thing. For the tanks, when they came in, they had fuel.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah, it was very, very intense.
What model of the CH-53? Because in Nam, like with Tailwind, they had the Delta model. Mm-hmm. So by the time
I think they call them E models or J models. I don't know. I never, you know.
Because by that time, they've got three engines.
Yeah. Well.
As a crew chief, what was that like? I mean, did you ever?
I never flew one.
Never flew one,
those,
huh?
No. That was also too new for me.
But still, more importantly, it's a part of the SOS history.
Yeah.
And so was there, before we could move forward with the SOS side of things, what anything else from your time in country? Because we've chatted before as you being as modest as you are, I hear these little tidbits from you from time to time, and they're just indicative of time and service. For how long in total then was your time in country, a lot of that flying missions?
Well, I flew 1,050 some hour combat hours, 1,000 and some sorties, of course. Probably of those sorties, maybe 300 were actual missions.
Going across the fence?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, more than that. But I'm talking about actual hot, you know.
Oh, hot LZs, okay, sure.
So, you know, it's hard to say, yeah, but it was good.
And so how many months altogether in country then? Because your second tour of duty, you're extended for your first tour, that's 18. Mm-hmm. Then you come back for another six.
Another
18. Not good at math, but I fear it's about a little 2 years plus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're the best years of my life, personally. But
oh, absolutely. I feel the same. The men you serve with for a mission like that.
You know, it's just, nothing compares. You know, you come back and, you know, you have success in business. You know, some people become millionaires. Some people are very happy, had very happy lives. But somehow it never compares to what we had
when we were,
you know, I've run companies that had a couple of hundred employees. However, I never felt as important as I did when I was a 20-year-old, you know, saving lives.
Yeah.
Saving you guys' lives.
Sure.
And that was the best thing that I ever did.
And, you know, seeing as how we're here in Vegas, on Thursday, there will be an annual breakfast where we have the veterans, the SOG veterans from CCS, Command and Control South, that we have a breakfast with the aviators, the 20th, the 195th,
right.
maybe the 182nd. I'm not sure if there's any others I'm missing, but there might be a couple. But more importantly, the point of that is we hold those breakfasts, and then at the end, they read the name of every KIA. And that is really impressive. Yeah. That's, I know the 20th lost people.
Yeah.
And the 195th, and those lists, my God, when they read through those lists like that, that really hits home. And I think that that's the price paid from the aviators. But regardless, I mean, for the guys on the ground, whenever we called, when they rang the bell, you guys always answered, always. Even if another ship got shot down, or like that day with Jim Fleming again, four helicopters go down, one's left, he's right there to the bitter end and was able to save the team thanks to the efforts of everybody.
Well,
my God, that's just a commitment.
It was our job.
Yeah.
That's all we had to do.
So just as we kind of get down the trail here a little, talk a little bit more about the, if you don't mind, or what you know from what happened with the 20th. Thereafter, they shut down for a while, deactivated, then they got reactivated.
Right.
And as part of that, because of the lineage, the history of the 20th during Vietnam, how it was formed as a combat Air Force unit?
I would assume so. I would assume that that's part of the reason why. I mean, they could have activated another unit, you know, called it whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, but they chose that, and they served in Panama. They served in the Operation OpBat, which was a suppression of drug trafficking. They also They also worked in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you know they've been everywhere.
And in Kosovo during those Serbia and all those.
They haven't gotten a lot of credit, you know. But,
sure.
But they did their thing.
Well, I mean. You know, we always hear about the Air Force. A lot of Air Force brass talks about their fighter jets, and of course with Spooky,
right,
and that side of thing. But the close air support, I mean, from what the 20th did in service, and then you also have the Jolly Green Giants, which has the motto that others may live.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time that I came into contact with that, not from a personal, but just hearing it. And knowing that they lost, like with Lynn Black, October 5th, they lost one Jolly Green on the LZ, another one came in, another one got shot out so bad it could barely get back to base.
Right.
And then the third one actually saved the team, could only fly over two mountaintops, and then they had to do an emergency landing.
Yeah,
I mean, that's commitment.
It is.
Absolute it is. Commitment. It they is. Lost several men there, and it just, anyways, that's part of our history. That's why we're here. So we're at that point, I think. Is there anything else you want to add from the history of the 20th, or thinking about anything we should cover, or a couple of questions I should ask you before we
wrap? I think we pretty much covered it.
It's amazing. It really is, because that, again, from speaking the perspective of a ground pounder, that was the key part, was that when we were in trouble, we were compromised, we had to get out. And who we call? We called our aviators. In this case, particularly
not
CCS. Say again?
Not Ghostbusters.
No. Definitely not the Ghostbusters. But we would call it a Green Hornet.
There you go.
And they always came. And I don't know. I just have a hard time not talking about it. I mean, we had that one mission when the mission was to find three NVA divisions. We found two of them. And they were coming for us. And if it hadn't been for the Green Hornets, I'd be Cambodia fertilizer today.
Wow. I'm glad we helped. I'm glad we
Absolutely.
Could help.
Absolutely. You done good, sir. So with that, I think we'll close out.
Okay.
And again, we thank RT for coming in and speaking to us today. And as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions for making this possible as we're recording from Las Vegas with the 48th Special Operations Association reunion. And as always, we thank all the service members, law enforcement, the Border Patrol, first responders, people that are out there today in the trenches serving our country, and we pray for them all. And last but not least, as always, we still have 1,574 Americans who are still listed as missing in action in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War, which includes 57 Green Berets from the Secret War, a total of 98 Green Berets that are still missing in action today from the war, including our SOG. On top of that, we've documented at least 83 aviators who have put their lives on the line while supporting SOG teams on the ground during the 8-year Secret War. Again, we thank Jocko Willink Productions, SOG Chronicles. God bless America.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.